Hello, good evening, and welcome. I am Samuel Trapp. This is Dam Radio. You are listening to my program, International Flavor. You can find past podcasts at internationalflavor.com. You can also find them on damradio.com/podcasts, and you will get all the prior versions for your own listening pleasure whenever you feel like it. And you can also get the rest of our wonderful lineup of talk show hosts here on Dam Radio. We encourage you to listen as much as possible. I have a lot to talk about tonight, but I'll probably only get through I'm going to spend the bulk of the time. I promised last week that I would speak to you a little bit more about this very interesting and somewhat deep conversation, presentation, if you will, that was given at the 13th annual St. Petersburg International Legal Forum. And it's for, it was very interesting to me. And today I spoke about, I planned on going into this anyway on the show tonight, but today I was doing my Russian version of this program on my YouTube channel in Russian. And I was talking about this presentation given by a guy named Andrei Bezrukov is his name. And I was talking about the presentation, and I got a notification, a message on my feed in Russian. Somebody sent it to me and said, "Are you aware that this guy was a KGB spy in the United States?" That the guy who's given the speech, him and his wife were both spies, and they made some kind of a movie about him. I don't know the name, but I was like, really? Now that could be interesting to find out more about, don't you think? We could find out some more about that, which would be really kind of interesting. So today I was sitting in a brand new home and waiting for people to come in. But here in Florida, it's like 95 degrees during the day. Nobody was out today. And I had one couple come in. So I had a lot of time to sit there and get some other work done. And so I researched this couple. And I thought, first of all, I thought his presentation was very interesting anyway. And it is called, and I think I've told you this already, his name is Andrei Bezrukov. And basically, it's a geopolitical insights that he has. But I also want to get into a little bit about his history and his wife's and their two sons. It was very interesting. They even created a mini-series about them, which I've seen the first season of. I bought the first season of it, or somehow got it for free, I don't remember, on Apple iTunes or whatever. It's called The Americans. And if you've seen The Americans, it was based on these two people. And so I thought it was rather interesting, and I did not know that part. I just thought it was an interesting, an advisor, or was an advisor to Putin. He was a consultant for several important places. We'll get into his background a little bit later and tell you more about him and what he was able to, accomplish in America. And they lived in America, got American educations. They also lived and were citizens. They got passports in Canada. And their sons were born in Canada, and their sons didn't know that their parents were spies until they were arrested by the FBI in 2010. Now, many of you probably know this. Maybe you've been paying more attention than I was way back then. But it, no matter how you slice it, it's an interesting story. But for my part, I wanted to get to I wanted to talk about, anyway, the amount of things that he was talking about on the forum, at the forum. He was talking very well at the forum, and it was very interesting, and very weird that I didn't know any of this. I didn't go and look up. I suppose this is an important lesson and safety tip. I was going to quote wherever the guy came from anyway. You know, I don't steal people's work. I want to, you know, credit them with their own work. And I was going to give credit where credit is due, of course, and give it to him. And his name is Andrei Bezrukov. We have 90 minutes to get through this. That's plenty of time to discuss it all. Plus, I've got a whole bunch of other news that I would like to discuss if we actually get there. But basically, I found this to be quite interesting. And I've fell upon this guy. I've actually seen him a couple of other times before, but frankly, I don't remember where. And what I want to do is dive into his provocative lecture. Andrei Bezrukov, his lecture was at the 13th Annual St. Petersburg International Legal Forum, which happened in 2025, and really not that long ago, less than a month, I think. And it's titled Global Geopolitics in the Era of the New American Reality. And I found it so interesting that I wanted to share it with you. I'm not saying I completely agree with it, but a lot of it makes a lot of sense, what he is saying. And then I find out that he's a former Russian spy. Now, I've been trying to find out what alleged spy work he actually did, but that is less open. There's nothing out there that's saying what he actually did as a spy. It just said that he was a KGB colonel, and so was his wife, and that they were both in Canada, and then lived some in the United States as well, had Canadian passports. That's how they got to get into America whenever they wanted. They had Canadian passports. So I also think, so he was at a legal forum. So I wanted to pay special attention because he had some fairly harsh words for the U.S. judicial branch's outsized influence. Like, it's very, he made some pretty pointed statements about the judicial branch and how it has seized power unto itself. And as you know, on this channel, there are several of us that talk about how they have taken control of great portions of our society, especially in Missouri. But he was more interested about the power of the Supreme Court and what that has done to the mix. And so anyway, I want to talk about it. I have plenty of time to get to it all, and I'll get through the bulk of his speech, which the chief points won't be too long. But if anybody feels like calling in, if anybody has seen the shows on I bought one season. And I watched most of it several years ago, but I never bought the other seasons. But apparently, it was on for 5 seasons, and a lot of it was fictionalized. His wife wrote a book, and so she has made some further endeavors. She doesn't do as much public speaking recently on any of those topics, and is kind of semi-retired, I suppose you'd call it, and she hasn't really been given a lot of public speeches or lectures anytime recently. But if you wish to call in and talk about this topic, I'd prefer to stay on these topics and other topics related tonight, at least until I get through this interesting speech that he gave, and then a little bit about their history and about their son's fights to retain Canadian citizenship. But if you wish to call in, you can do that at 573-746-8020. And I hope you find this interesting, and or as interesting as I did. And maybe if you're not a big history nut, maybe you just won't. But I found it quite intriguing, if nothing else. And it was, no matter how you slice it, pretty damn entertaining. And to go through all of this today, and I read a good amount of history about stuff that I absolutely knew nothing about until I did, but I didn't realize it was based on, I don't want to say it's based on a true story, it's fictionalized, obviously, but that they did arrest some people who were sleepers, and this guy was one of them. So anyway, I already told you the name, the title of it, on the geopolitics, and basically, his lecture frames the era we're living in right now as a historic turning point, and His lecture was an hour and a half, but when you take notes on it, clearly comes out quite a bit shorter, because I just want to get to the chief points in it, okay? And he compares our current time, where we're living right now, to 1914 to 1945, when global conflicts and technological leaps reshape the entire world. He predicted that there's going to be 20 very turbulent years in front of us, driven by AI, artificial intelligence, society shifts, which are happening everywhere, and ongoing crises, which he says the same thing I have, and I didn't realize until I tried to get the details of this. I say these societal changes and the shifting going on in global politics has been happening since 2008. I argue right after Putin's appearance at the Munich Security Council and the speech he gave that was pretty in your face. And right after that is when BRICS came into being as a political force to be kind of recognized with. Anyway, he says it's leading to a right now an unrecognizable global order. So the global order that existed in 08 has been in turmoil, and he says that turmoil is going to continue another 20 years or so. And America was once the unchallenged, hegemonical giant, I suppose you would call it. And he says we are declining and struggling to adapt. We have profound implications on the global stage for all of that, and that Trump is kind of an answer to that. Bezrukov identifies three drivers of this phenomena: scientific progress, AI, societal change, and persistent crises. We've had continual crisis since 2000. I'm very interested in this, and I want to compare today's geopolitical shifts to the early 20th century. And which is what he did. He said the U.S. and Germany led technological advancement with things like the radio, electricity, internal combustion engines, and Britain and France, who were, up until that time, the top dogs financially, militarily, globally, caused a spark in the First World War between Germany and them, and somewhat us on the periphery, but World War I was was a financial war to curb competition. Today, he sees the U.S. doing some of the same things that France and Britain were doing then, with sanctions, with tariffs, with trade, and with things like that. Obviously, we don't think we can go the way of France and of England, but he argues that it's possible that we can. And so he sees the U.S. today, sanctions and conflicts, trying to slow China, that mirror the historical efforts against Germany by everybody else. Post-World War II, America held 50% of the global economy, okay? And they built institutions like the CIA and the Bretton Woods and Swift Banking is where all that began. And this globalization optimized production by U.S. held it all after World War II. We were, hands down, the most powerful. And Stalin spent however many years till Brezhnev came along to have the Soviet Union attempt to catch up, right? But we, as we got richer, the rich upper class started outsourcing our production, just like England and France had done, sending it over to places that were cheaper, like Germany, like America. We have been doing the same, like sending it to China, outsourcing to India, outsourcing to other places where, and you can't help it. I mean, nobody's blaming anybody. It just is that production goes where it's cheapest. And it's cheapest to send it elsewhere, right? And so the U.S., having held 50% of the global economy, exported their industrial base, and the middle class took the beating for that. And all of this sets the stage for the current challenges that we are facing. And Mr. Bezrukov argues this era of American-led globalization is fading. It's creating a fragmented world of competing blocs. NATO, Southeast Asia, India, China, Russia. He says there are only three countries who have the ability to internalize everything, to take care of themselves completely by themselves, with natural resources, with food, with technology, with factories, with people. And those three countries are America, Brazil, and Russia. Everybody else has to import things. Now, I don't understand why he says that China is not in that group. Maybe because of food? I don't know. But I thought they had a pretty good food. But I did not have time to look into that today. But that would be an interesting, I don't know, thing to find out. Interesting topic to research and find out if it's really the case that China doesn't have the ability to produce everything that it needs for itself. He says that America right now is at a crossroads, that its global economic share is down to 17%, down from 50 back in the right after the war, World War II, I mean. And we're completely unable to sustain hegemony. Now, I've been talking about that at least a year, especially since my trip to the BRICS summit and checking out the growth and the strength of that organization. And I find that quite an interesting topic still. But he says the key issues for America are economic and social decay. Outsourcing has eroded the American middle class and leaves only rich and poor in many cities, nobody in between. We're politically dysfunctional, And again, this is an outsider looking in. Well, maybe he's not an outsider after you find out his background. But it's we have a polarized Congress, a deep state of bureaucrats who resist change, and they are rooted in outdated post-World War II institutions. We have cultural shifts, namely the Latinization of America and rising Latino influence, people like Marco Rubio, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Ron DeSantis, people like that. We shift focus from the transatlantic, you know, east and west, to a north and south. And we have our American ties are north and south, and NATO is weakening. And we are, I don't want to say withdrawing from it, because we're not, but there's arguments that we have bigger fish to fry, you know. And the last one is financial manipulation, that shareholder capitalism has driven profits through stock buybacks and monetary bubbles. And the Pentagon funds costly, impractical, large-scale weapons and continual war. Now, many of those things I agree with. I believe we have an economic and a social decay. I certainly believe there's a political dysfunction. I see a cultural shift, especially in what has happened over the last 4 or 5 years. And financial manipulation, I believe that to be true, but at different levels for each one of those things. He argues, and this is where we get to the part that I'm really interested in. He argues that the U.S. judicial branch, especially the Supreme Court, which is the most powerful branch, and this is an outsider looking in, he says it surpasses legislative and executive authority. Justices who rise from elite institutions like Harvard or Yale undergo rigorous vetting, ensuring that they are also mentally elite, that they are part of the elite, and they feel their power as elite, right? Their lifetime appointments insulate them from democratic accountability, just like I've been arguing for a long time. They allow a single judge to block policies backed by millions of voters, such as the recent Trump initiatives. Bezrukov asked the following question. If Trump says something and a judge somewhere says no, no, and all these people who voted, they don't have any power, do they? This creates a legitimacy crisis, as the judiciary's elite loyalty stifles reforms needed for America to compete in AI and other technologies against China. He frames the judiciary as part of the deep state, alongside agencies like the CIA, who resist change and paralyze governance by the executive branch, and also partially of the legislative branch. And the entrenched judicial power hinders addressing inequality, rebuilding education, investing in infrastructure, which are all critical for global competitiveness. He predicts another battle. Either Trump supporters are going to force judicial reform, or the judiciary will maintain its autonomy, and thus we will continue to stagnate, in his words. His geopolitical lens ties judicial overreach to America's declining ability to lead in a multipolar world where regional blocs like China's are rising. And it's a notable framing domestic judicial power as a global strategic liability. Now, I found that very interesting, and I wanted to delve a little bit deeper. And so what I did was I went and researched just how I thought it was interesting that Supreme Court justices, okay, we're going to go and look at a number of post 25, okay, this is since post 1925 by law school, how many justices there are. Now, frankly, there weren't that many in the first place, okay? And but we can go into this list and see exactly where they come from in the Supreme Court. It is unbelievable to me that if we go after 1950, okay, I was interested in two things when I did this research. I was interested in what law schools justices are coming from and how long they remain in power. Because remember, a few weeks ago, I told you about the efforts of term or whatever it's called to limit. There's a couple of proposals that haven't gone anywhere to limit the terms of Supreme Court justices. And if this doesn't bother you, it really should. Okay, I mean, in my humble opinion. Now, get this. After 1950 is the only research I did. And that's because there's only been, get this, there have only been 24 Supreme Court justices that served post-1950. How do you like that? And it's amazing to me that that is the case. And think about this. And of those, here it is, U.S. Supreme Court justices by law school post-1950. If this doesn't bother you, it really should, in my opinion. Because we don't have any control over this. Who do you think, how do you think they are getting picked? Do you think we have anything to do with it? Do you think the Senate really has anything to do with it? I don't think so, friends and neighbors. And here's who we have. We have Harvard Law School. Number one, Harvard Law School has 9 justices. Felix Frankfurter, I remember reading about Justice Frankfurter in law school, who served from 23 years, from 1939 to 1962. And at the age, and he died at age 82, but he left the court at age 79. He served for 23 years. William Brennan served from 1956 to 1990, 34 years on the court, 34 years. And he died at age 91, but he had given up the court at age 84. Anton Scalia, who died in office at age 79, 1986 to 2016, served for 30 years. Anthony Kennedy, 1988 to 2018, and he's still alive. And he retired in 2018 after 30 years. Okay. And he's 88 right now. So he retired, how many would that be? That'd be 8 years ago or 7 years ago, right? So he retired at age 80. Stephen Breyer, who is still living, he retired he'd retired 3 years ago at age 83. When he retired, he served from 1994 to 2022, a total of 28 years. Chief Justice John Roberts, who has been serving for 20 years, he's currently 70, and he's been serving since 2005. Elena Kagan, she's been serving for 15 years. She's age 65 right now. Neil Gorsuch has been serving since 2017 for 8 years. He's age 57 right now. Ketanji Brown Jackson has been serving for 3 years, and she's only age 54. Okay? So they're getting younger when they take office and older when they leave, and they are staying on for a long time. And those are all 9 Harvard Law Schools since 1950. The second school is Yale. There's Potter Stewart, who served 23 years, 1958 to 1981. Byron White, 62 to 93, served for 31 years. Abbe Fortas, 1965 to 69. He served for 4 years, and he died in 1982 at age 71. Clarence Thomas, who's been on the court for 34 years, is 76 right now, and he's been serving since 1991. Samuel Alito is also from Yale, and he has been on the court for 19 years. He is 75. Sonia Sotomayor, 2009, for 16 years, she's 70. Brett Kavanaugh, he's been on the court for 7 years, and he's only 60. So, get this, we have 4 from Harvard right now, 4 from Yale right now, and 1 from Notre Dame. First one ever from Notre Dame. She's been on for 5 years, Amy Coney Barrett, okay? Now, meanwhile, there's a bunch of deceased ones. William Douglas served from 1939 to 1975. He served for 36 years on the court. Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who also went to Harvard, but she graduated from Columbia, just like William Douglas, and she transferred there. And she died at age 87 after serving 27 years on the court. William Douglas served 36 years on the court. A couple from Stanford, William Rehnquist, 33 years on the court. And he died in 2005 at age 80. And he served from 33 years from 72 to 05. Sandra Day O'Connor, she died in 23 at age of 93. And she served from 81 to 06 for 25 years. There was one justice from Northwestern, Judge Paul Stevens, from 75 to 2010, 35 years. He died at age 99 in 2019. He quit at age 90, people. He quit at age 90. University of California, Berkeley. Earl Warren, 53 to 69. He was 63. And then Notre Dame. And that's it. That's your entire list of people who've served after 1950. Isn't that crazy? And you think we don't need to discuss this topic? I mean, nobody said that, obviously. But think about that. That is incredible to me that we are really... That's where we are, and it makes no sense to me at all. It's just crazy to me where we are in this horror story of our legal structure. Okay, so I hope you find that as interesting as I did. To go there, and we talked about the judicial branches overpowering, and you know why. And if you don't think that needs to change, well, you know, I suppose that's okay. But boy, I tell you what, it'd be nice if it was a bigger issue, for Americans, because it's really not. So I don't know, but he says this power is a big deal for the rest of the world as well. And he intimated that he believes that this power is consolidated purposefully, and that they have taken all these additional powers to themselves that we talk about so much, and you cannot question the legal structure or the legal system or how it's organized or anything like that. You're not allowed to even question it. You're just supposed to think, oh, it's judicial branch. Come on, they're the good guys. But they're all from the same two schools. Why? Why is that? Why? You don't think there are smart people from other areas? I tried to get a good set of numbers on other federal judgeships everywhere. And remember, both those are highly liberal schools. Liberal, liberal, liberal. And there's a huge number in the appellate courts as well. An enormous number in the appellate courts of people from the same two schools. It's a crazy number. And maybe next week I will have time to dig into specific numbers of that. But the numbers aren't as easy to find, because there's not like a couple of federal judge sites out there that research it for you, but it's hard to accumulate. You got to look in a lot more spots to get it. So at any rate, continuing on with Mr. Bezrukov's forecasts, because he says we are destined for an internal struggle for America if we're going to stay in the lead of the next technological cycle, including AI trends. There's a technological race. Tech giants like Musk and Bezos back Trump to invest in AI. But judicial and bureaucratic resistance will continue to hinder their progress. This is an outsider telling us this. Institutional rebuilding, just like the post-Civil War and post-World War II cycles, America has to overhaul its governance, but judicial power and polarization complicate this. He said that the Democratic Party has intentionally held down younger generations, and he says that take a look at the Democratic Party and you won't find anybody between the ages of 50 and 70. The entire generation is gone. The same bozos have been holding power in the Democratic Party. He called them the Clintonistas. The Clintonistas have held power. Anybody that, including people like Nancy Pelosi, you know, people like that. But go and find out, where is the next generation of Democrats? It doesn't exist. They're looking to people like Alicia, or what's her name? Oxana. Cortacio Cortez or Ocasio Cortez or whatever her name is. They're looking for people like that, is who they are. They are talking about. He says the institution rebuilding is going to, have a lot of problems because of that. And now we have Musk saying we should create a new party. Maybe that's what he and Trump were doing, if they really were creating this war between themselves as a real deal. He says that America has a social and educational decline. Absolutely true. Fewer engineers, especially when compared to Russia, India, and China. They have a healthcare cartel that imposes a 20% cost penalty that weakens competitiveness. There's a global retreat. America's attempting to form a North American bloc retreating from Europe and destabilizing regions like South Eurasia to counter competitors. So if they can create problems in Georgia, the country, not the state, if they can create problems in Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, all the stands, that's a help to us. It helps to stabilize against what's going on in the India and China spheres. And then new elites, young Democrats or new Republicans, may drive reform, but the entrenched leadership resists. And Russia, argues Bezrukov, they can leverage this period of instability to build a Eurasian bloc also with India and China. And they're well on their way to doing that, especially because they're such natural partners anyway. At any rate, that's pretty much the... I obviously couldn't translate it word for word. I did manage to download it all in Russian, and I'm going to have it translated by AI here, and I may actually post it somewhere for people to read. It was very interesting, the entire speech, and I listened to it again. I've listened to it 3 times now, and I was intrigued by it. I thought I would save it. And like I told you, I was making a comment about it a little bit in Russian today on my Russian channel, my Russian YouTube channel. And I found that pretty interesting. When someone sent me a bunch of information, well, not a bunch of information, just a question. And that question was, did you know that he and his wife were both spies arrested by the FBI in America? No, I didn't know that. So I went and I looked, and I have the following to report to you. I found this quite interesting. So basically, Bezrukov, his name is Andrei Bezrukov, and his wife's name is, let's start with him. He was born in 1960 in Kansk, Siberia, and Elena Vavilova was born in 1962 in Tomsk. And they met at Tomsk State University, studying history. And both were recruited by the KGB in the 1980s. And they were what they call razvedchiki. And razvedchiki are basically intelligence officers. That's what they always called us, even as a young sergeant. They was like, oh, you're razvedchik, means not quite a spy, but you're a, I don't know what, you're always, you're accused of being a spy. Kaka razvedchik, you're somebody who's going to dig in and find out stuff about them. And so that's what they allegedly were. And so they were recruited by the KGB. They moved to Canada. And this is interesting. They adopted the identities of deceased Canadians, Donald Heathfield and Tracy Foley. And they were living in Canada, France, and the U.S. for over 20 years. Bezrukov earned a Harvard master's degree in 2000. He worked at a company called Global Partners Incorporated, and he founded Future Map and networked with all kinds of U.S. elites. Vavilova, who is also a KGB colonel, worked as a real estate agent at Redfin and organized wine tours together. Arrested in 2010, under Operation Ghost Stories, they were exchanged in Vienna for 4 Russians, including Sergei Skripal. In Russia, they received the Order of Merit to the Fatherland, 4th class. Bezrukov is a Rosneft, that's Russian oil, Rosneft advisor, and a MGIMO professor, that's a Moskovsky government institution, university, basically. Vavilova consults with Norilsk Nickel and writes novels. Their Razvidchiki, spies, fame stems from the 2010 FBI bust where they got picked up. And it was amplified by the show The Americans and Western media like The Washington Post and The Guardian, contrasting with Russian portrayals of their patriotism and what they have done. Now, what I tried to do was find out what they were actually accused of as spies, because that's of interest to me. You can't just come over and live in the U.S. under a fake name and be accused as a spy. I want to know what you did. You know, it's easy to say you're a spy. What else? Come on. They were accused of acting as unregistered foreign agents for Russia's SVR, which is a successor to the KGB, under the illegals program. It's the same thing that they allege about people who brought you Russia Today, the newspapers. Aimed at gathering intelligence by blending into American society. So if you blend into American society and you're someone from another country, I suppose if you could be an unregistered foreign agent. The FBI's Operation Ghost story culminated in their 2010 arrest, charged them with conspiracy to act as unregistered agents and money laundering, but not with access or accessing classified material or special compartmented information. So when I served in the military, I had access to very high level materials, including certain levels of special compartmented information, highly sensitive data requiring specific clearance. U.S. authorities alleged that they sought to build contacts with academics, industrialists, and policymakers to gather intelligence, but no charges confirmed access to anything secret. So Bezrukov, his activities. As Donald Heathfield, he networked with influential figures, including a former national security advisor to Vice President Al Gore, Leon Firth, and a George Washington University professor named William Halal at World Future Society conferences. A 2005 message indicated contact with a former high-ranking U.S. government national security official, and a 2004 message referenced discussions about nuclear bunker buster warheads with a government research facility worker. These suggest attempts to gather unclassified but sensitive policy and technological insight, not SCI, which is typically restricted to cleared personnel. His Harvard education and Future Map consultancy facilitated access to elite circles, but public records show no evidence of penetrating classified systems. Vavilov's activity, her name was Tracy Foley. As Tracy Foley, she focused on maintaining their cover, worked as a real estate agent, and managed their family life to appear ordinary. Her role supported Bezrukov's networking with no direct evidence of her accessing any sensitive information. The FBI alleged that she sent encrypted messages to Moscow, but these were described as general intelligence, not SCI. The nature of the intelligence, the illegals program prioritized long-term open source intelligence, policy trends, economic insight, and technological development over classified data. Meaning, take what you can get in open source. We don't care if you get classified data. Their training, detailed in Vavilova's novel, included evading surveillance, coding, and language skills, but no SCI access, which requires formal vetting, and they lacked that as covert operatives. Their sons had no idea of their activities, which suggests a focus on subtle societal infiltration rather than high-tech security breach. The lack of SCI-related charges against either of them reflects the strategy. building trust and influence over decades, not immediate classified access. Western media, like the Boston Globe and the Guardian, speculate they gathered strategic insights, but U.S. officials emphasize no classified material was compromised, distinguishing their case from traditional espionage involving SCI. How about that? Isn't that interesting? And their sons, they had two of them, they had their citizenship efforts. Basically, Timothy was born in 1990 in Canada, and his brother, Alexander Vavilov, was born in 94. They're born in Toronto under their parents' cover identities. And after the parents were arrested in 2010, their citizenship in Canada was revoked. And Canada argued that their parents' espionage equated to diplomatic status. The Supreme Court of Canada in December 2019 ruled that both got to retain their citizenship under something called jus soli, as their parents lacked diplomatic privilege. CBS News 2019 reports that Alexander intended to return to Canada for an investment banking career, and there were no recent updates. U.S. claims that Timothy was groomed for espionage were denied by the brothers. The TV show The Americans, inspired by Bezrukov and Vavilova, ran on FX from January 30, 2013 to May 30, 2018. Six seasons, 75 episodes. The publication Screen Rant in 2023 notes its basis in their covert lives, amplifying their Western notoriety as spies raising children that were unaware. Yelena Vavilova, no 2025 public appearances by her on geopolitical topics, similar to Bezrukov's lecture. She has novels called A Woman Who Can Keep Secrets, that she wrote in 2019, The Encrypted Heart, 2021, Parallel Life, 2023, all explore espionage with themes of Russia's global role aligning with Bezrukov's multipolar vision. She co-authored Networking for Spies in 2023 with Bezrukov, a bestseller on intelligence networking. She lectures at Moscow's Orators Club on leadership and works for Norilsk Nickel, but her public profile is much lower than Bezrukov's. Bezrukov's critique of the U.S. judiciary power echoes conservative U.S. debates, like mine, but his geopolitical framing is unique. There's a couple who put out similar publications. John Yoo, Federalist Society, 2021. He has Defender-in-Chief, 2020. Ilya Shapiro, Heritage Foundation, 2023. In Supreme Disorder, 2021. Adrian Vermeule, AEI, 2022. Common Good Constitutionalism, 2020. He criticizes elite judicial culture. I might read a lot of these books here coming up before too long. Who can tell? I think I might have to read some of these now. Ray Dalio, The Changing World Order, is another person to read. His Changing World Order in 2020 aligns with Bezrukov's view of U.S. decline and regional blocs, but ignores the judiciary. There's a guy called George Friedman, The Storm Before the Calm, 2020. The End of the World is Just the Beginning by Peter Zeihan in 2022 predicts U.S. retreat and regionalization, but also views Russia as declining and not as able to balance anything related to the Eurasian markets that we were talking about earlier. I don't know, but all I can tell you is that I have decided that I want to know quite a bit more about all of this and reading up on it. Wow. I tell you what, I found that interesting. I hope that you did as well, and that you spread out this episode to others and let other people know about this rather interesting concept that I have somewhat stumbled on, you know, listening to the very interesting topic that we, you know, I like to talk about the judiciary and how I believe the judiciary is overpowering the other two branches of government. It's a crazy topic, truthfully, and well worth digging into some more. I wanted to, if I can, go back and tell you the exact names of these two, because there was a little bit more information that I took in my notes, and I thought it was pretty worthwhile. Where is she? To talk about their complete names came up, and be very good to be able to tell you where that is. Here you go. The name she took, her full name is Elena Stanislavovna Vavilova, born in 1962 in Russia. The name she took, and she operated under the alias Tracy Leanne Foley. She's a Canadian citizen. And then, let's see. Andrei Olegovich Bezrukov is his real name, and he took the alias of Donald Howard Heathfield, the son of a Canadian diplomat who died in 1962. And so he somehow folded into all of that, and it's interesting to me how they did it. Does it make you want to go and watch The Americans again if you didn't before? Like I said, I only watched most of the first season, and I actually forgot all about it, but it's on my iTunes. So apparently I bought the first season at some point and have been watching it, and or had been at some point watching it. So I found it pretty dang interesting. So I wanted to talk since I spoke at length about this today, and I talked a tiny bit about it on Thursday, but we really didn't know. The Ukrainians have turned away the bodies of their fallen. So Russia has 1,200 bodies in refrigerator trucks at the border. They have named approximately 1,200 more prisoners, severely injured, those under the age of 25. Those are who they're trying to get Ukraine to come and get, and Ukraine won't come and get them. They're leaving them sit. Russia has unilaterally said that they would like to deliver these dead people. And now, since they've been sitting at the border for 2-3 days now, and Ukraine is not coming picking them up, they have posted their names. They've started releasing them on Telegram and on websites, releasing the names of the fallen to put pressure on Zelensky, I presume, because now people in Ukraine are going to be extremely upset about this. Because, I mean, why wouldn't you take the bodies of the fallen so you can bury them appropriately? And now, on top of that, Ukraine has now put in there's a new law that they're looking to pass, or they may have already passed it, that says that you don't get the money that you want to, that for your family, you don't get the money for your fallen soldier. Like if I die in while I'm serving in the army in America, everybody has a $200,000 life insurance policy that, I think you got to pay something for it. I don't remember what it costs, but it's very low cost because everybody has one. And that's really to, so the government doesn't have to come up with money to pay you if you die in a war or something, right? And they wouldn't anyway, because for us it's a contractual thing. But in Russia and Ukraine, it's different. The government pays them if someone is killed. There's not like an insurance policy. They get money. And so these grivnia, they get a good amount, and the people are saying that the return of these 6,000 people is going to mean that the government of Ukraine has to somehow fund their families' payments so that they get this. They say it could be as much as $1.5 billion, $2 billion, with all of the injured people, with all of the dead, with everybody that is coming back. And so Ukraine has this new law that either has passed or is trying to pass that now says you don't get that money until 2 years after the war is over. How's that going to help you? I don't know. I don't think I'll go. That's a depressing topic, but it's really unbelievable that they aren't taking it. Russia's been bombing the crap out of them for the last 4 or 5 days. Again, last night they bombed them. I don't see anything new in there today, but I did want to cover a couple. There's a story about J.D. Vance stating that Biden's Ukrainian spending is downright crazy. Washington was spending crazy amounts of money on Ukraine under the administration of Joe Biden without any thought to diplomacy, said J.D. Vance. Earlier this year, Trump restarted diplomatic relations with Moscow, which have been frozen since Biden cut them off after the escalation of the Ukraine conflict in 2022. Trump has repeatedly criticized the massive flow of military aid that Washington has provided Kyiv. What happened with the Biden administration? Man, it's crazy. They were spending so much money all over the world, they weren't even engaged in diplomacy at all, Vance said in an interview with American comedian turned podcaster Theo Von that was published on Saturday. They sent $300 billion to Ukraine, for example, and you never had the President of the United States actually trying to force or even discuss, I would say, a diplomatic settlement. The U.S. Vice President described the conflict as vicious. The Russia-Ukraine thing is a most vicious thing, he said, adding that he's pleased that Washington is trying to bring about a settlement. The current U.S. administration has engaged Russia in several high-level meetings in recent months, blah, blah, blah. In April, Trump signed a major minerals exploitation deal with Kyiv. This gives the U.S. priority access to Ukrainian mineral wealth, but doesn't include formal security guarantees for Kyiv, which is what they really wanted. You know, they wanted something pretty, excuse me, serious, and insisted upon it, but they didn't get it. The America First switch is part of Trump's pivot away from the decades-old approach to foreign policy, said Vance last month. The era of uncontested U.S. dominance is over. Does that sound familiar to anyone? He said, promising that Washington will be turning away from open-ended conflicts. Well, don't worry, J.D. They'll be back as soon as you guys leave office. We'll go right back to it, don't you think? They don't know anything else. I mean, good luck with that theory. I hope it works out for us. To hell with you, no offense, but I hope it I hope it ends, but who knows? Let's see, what else do we have here? Here's one. The new Russian sanctions bill is on hold, according to Bloomberg. Now, I'm not so sure about this, but I found it interesting anyway. The senators behind the bone-crushing legislation are not willing to challenge the White House, said an outlet, Bloomberg. The latest drive in the U.S. Congress for more sanctions on Russia, spearheaded by Lindsey Graham, is now stalled due to Donald Trump's opposition, Bloomberg reported over the weekend. Lindsey Graham's bone-crushing legislation that can impose a 500% tariff on countries that buy Russian energy, uranium, and other raw materials has more than 80 co-sponsors in the Senate, which Bloomberg described as veto-proof backing. But lawmakers are still hesitant to challenge the president, said the outlet. Earlier this week, Trump said he had not even looked at the bill and would only consider sanctions at the right time. And his position put the brakes on a push to advance the measure as soon as this month, according to Bloomberg. Graham has previously said he planned to do so before the G7 summit scheduled for June 15 to 17 in Canada, but the effort is now on hold, said Bloomberg. I would like to find out what exactly Lindsey Graham says on this. Maybe more than enough people are starting to say this is BS with him going over there, and people don't want this. People in America are not pro-Ukraine war. They're just not. This is not our fight. What in the world do we don't care. We don't give a crap. You know, it'd be different if we had something to gain from it. But you have a backwards country with a backwards leadership, and they're treating people in a backwards fashion. If you just go back and listen to some of the things that I have been saying, and I'm not alone. There are plenty of people talking about this and how it comes out. On Thursday, the Republican senator wrote on X that they're talking here about Graham, wrote on X that he had coordinated closely with the White House on this endeavor from day one. And he added that the bill was only aimed at giving Trump more tools when it comes to Russia. Nonsense. The bill's Democrat co-sponsor, Richard Blumenthal, told Bloomberg that he and Graham were still working on making the bill more acceptable to the White House. On Thursday, Trump told journalists he had a deadline in his brain and would decide when to act if it became clear that a peace deal between Moscow and Kiev could not be reached. He also stated that he was willing to impose sanctions against both Russia and Ukraine. All I want him to do is not give him any more money. Now, there's another story that I read last couple of days that said, because remember, Zelensky is supposed to fly over with Mertz last week, and Trump said, oh, no, you're not sneaking the little green goblin in front of me just because I agreed to see you. You know, so he came over, Mertz did, and the president congratulated him on his victory and his new post and blah, blah, blah. And they had their little White House Oval Office discussions and talked about, you know, NATO. And Trump wasn't very nice about that either. But now we hear that Ukraine, which is not part of the G7, is planning on sending, or Zelensky's planning on coming to the G7 conference anyway, and meeting with Trump, and Trump will probably meet with him. And what's his goal? $38 billion, which he can't get from Europe. And he's dying. I mean, they've been downgraded on credit once again. They have no more weapons. They can't get any more patriots. I saw an article today that Trump is refusing them more patriots. We don't have enough of our own. And Ukraine, meanwhile, is getting the snot bombed out of them. Every day in Russia, the lines are advancing, and Ukraine is getting more and more. And so what did they do? They attacked Russia, deep inside of Russia. They're still going after civilian targets, like bridges, like train bridges in front of trains, and killing civilians intentionally. You can say some of that about Russia if you like, and I don't know the actual truth on it. I couldn't tell you. I know that they say certain things, and I don't believe Ukrainian propaganda at all. So I don't know. Let's finish this article, though. The president said the Senate sanctions bill would be guided by me. Uh-huh. And he suggested it might be better to let Russia and Ukraine continue fighting for a while before pulling them apart. He expressed his concern about recent Ukrainian drone attacks on long-range, nuclear-capable Russian bombers, which I believe Lindsey Graham had something to do with. That's what I believe, but I was wrong once before. Don't know when, but I had to have been wrong once. Saying it increased the risk of escalation by giving Moscow a reason to retaliate. Moscow has accused Kyiv of escalating its attacks in an effort to undermine U.S.-backed peace talks. Russia claims that Trump is receiving filtered information about the conflict from those pushing Washington to support Ukraine, blindly, by the way, without even saying why. Anyway, interesting article. Another article from the Wall Street Journal says Trump might leave the new legislation toothless. U.S. President Trump is pushing to dilute a Senate bill aimed at imposing sanctions on Russia, said the Wall Street Journal, citing sources close to the administration. The proposed legislation includes steep 500% tariff on imports from any country that buys oil, gas, uranium, or key commodities from Moscow. The sanctions bill is introduced in April by a group led by Lindsey Graham and Rick Blumenthal. In addition to tariffs, the measure includes secondary sanctions targeting countries that maintain commercial ties with Russia. Graham has described the bill as one of the most draconian sanctions bills ever written, and restrictions as bone-crushing. In recent weeks, the White House officials have quietly contacted Graham's office and urged him to water down the bill. They suggest adding exceptions to the bill that allow the president to choose who would be subject to restrictions. In particular, Graham was asked to replace the bill's mandatory language, substituting shall with may. While any administration can ask for changes in a bill like this one, eliminating the mandatory nature of sanctions renders Graham's bill toothless, said the Wall Street Journal. They stressed that Trump already has the discretion to impose sanctions. Blumenthal confirmed to the Wall Street Journal that there had been private negotiations with Trump's administration, and he declined to comment on the substance. We're moving ahead, and the White House is included in our conversations. In the Oval Office on Thursday, Trump told reporters that the sanctions bill moving through the Senate is guided by him, but suggested it might be letter blah, 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 same that we read in the last article. So there's plenty of people talking about it. So Politico, same thing. Rand Paul wrote in recently the responsible statecraft publication that the bill essentially amounts to an embargo that could trigger economic calamity on a scale never before seen in our country. He added that such punitive measures are unlikely, I say completely unlikely, to change Moscow's core strategic goals and only further entrench the U.S. in a failing foreign policy approach. Senator Paul is one of the smartest guys in the Senate and probably one of the most decent, you know. The sanctions bill, blah, 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 we know about that. Graham proposed amendments, we know about that. Already got there as well. Here's the story I was telling you a little bit. Russian officials have unveiled the identities of nearly 100 fallen Ukrainian soldiers who are among the 6,000 Moscow has offered to return to Kyiv in a unilateral humanitarian gesture during the latest round of peace talks in Istanbul last Monday. The governor of Russia's Zaporizhia region, Yevgeny Balitsky, published the first 6 pages that contain 97 names, identification documents, and places of death on Saturday evening after Ukraine refused to receive the remains of the troops. We are beginning to publish lists of identified bodies so that relatives can find their dead, he wrote. We understand that Kyiv has this data, but they are deliberately hiding it from the public. The Istanbul talks resulted in agreement to exchange at least 1,000 prisoners on both sides, including critically ill and those under 25. Russia offered to turn over all 6,000 fallen Ukrainian soldiers for proper burial as part of the unilateral initiative. The first convoy carrying the remains of 1,212 troops arrived at the exchange point Saturday, but the Ukrainian side has failed to appear, according to Lieutenant General Alexander Zorin, member of the Russian negotiating team who was there. The Ukrainian side unexpectedly postponed both the acceptance of the bodies and the exchange of prisoners of war for an indefinite period. Russia's lead negotiator, Vladimir Medinsky, confirmed that Kyiv had been handed a list of 640 wounded and young prisoners but did not show up at the exchange. The reasons provided were various and rather strange, he said, urging Kyiv to adhere strictly to the schedule and agreements reached last Monday to ensure that the dead receive a proper burial. Ukraine's coordination headquarters denies these accusations, claiming that both sides have been preparing for the prisoner and body exchanges. Ukrainian media later reported the process has been postponed until next week, though no official new date has been confirmed. Balitsky accuses Kyiv of deliberately obstructing the return of the bodies, alleging that Ukrainian authorities are trying to conceal the scale of their military losses and avoid paying compensation to the families of the dead. A small sip of my tea, non-caffeine, caffeine-free tea, late at night. As long as a Ukrainian soldier is listed as missing, his family will not receive a single hryvnia, that's their currency, in aid, the governor said. This is a calculated attempt to hide the losses and save money. The refusal to retrieve the bodies is part of a broader pattern of violations by Ukraine, said Balitsky, claiming that Kyiv does not even attempt to honor the agreements. He has blamed Western countries for derailing peaceful resolution efforts by continuing to arm Kyiv and escalate the conflict. Is that not crazy? I don't know how I feel about that. I don't know that I'd like to hear about it by reading it in the newspaper, published by another country, I think I'd probably have not done that were I the governor of Zaporizhia. I don't know that I would have put out the names of the soldiers. And like he said, those names were already in possession of Kiev authorities, but they hadn't told the families. And I believe that's probably the case, that they are not telling families because the families would then be able to claim money. But like I said, there were creating new rules to receive the money anyway. And I don't know. The war needs to end sooner rather than later. And it would be nice if people worked in that area. One of my favorites, Maria Zakharova, she's the foreign ministry spokeswoman for Russia. She's a smartass. She gets on and says she's now accusing Ukraine of self-inflicted genocide because they won't come and pick up the bodies. Where's the exact quote? There is no nation or ethnic group in the world that would refuse to bury its own soldiers. But that's the Kiev regime, which professes a misanthropic ideology and is committing genocide against its own people, said Zakharova. And she also said in Telegram later, she said the deliberate inaction of Zelensky's government says it shows that Ukraine or the government does not need its people, neither dead nor alive. Now that's harsh. Russian MP Dmitry Bielik, who's a member of the State Duma, his International Affairs Committee, said that Ukraine failing to accept the bodies of its soldiers could be its unwillingness to pay compensation to the families. That's where that came from. This is how thinking of how to stuff their own wallets and not give a penny to their citizens. The Kiev regime, led by Zelensky, pursues its bloody policy and destroys its own people, said Bielik. Former Pentagon analyst Michael Maloof suggested that Ukraine's decision could be rooted in financial concerns. I think they are embarrassed by the numbers. I've heard sums up to around more than $1 billion that they would have to repay families, and they don't have the money, he said. The chairman of Russia's Parliament Foreign Affairs Committee, Leonid Slutsky, told RT that the move by Ukrainian authorities is an example of rare cynicism and a disregard for the memory of their own fallen servicemen. In a war to the last Ukrainian, said Slutsky, they are exclusively focused on preserving their own power, even at the cost of actual sacrilege. That's directed straight at Zelensky. Kiev explained its refusal to collect the remains of its troops by claiming the date of the transfer had not yet been agreed upon. So, who knows, people? Who knows? There's more about the bone-crushing sanctions. What else do we have here of interest to us? There's a Ferdinand Kartheiser, who's an EU Parliament member in Luxembourg, says that Brussels is gripped by anti-Russian war hysteria. Anti-Russian sentiment in Brussels verges upon war hysteria, said Ferdinand Kartheiser. He was expelled from his parliamentary group over a recent visit to Moscow. Remember, I told you about him when he went I think he was at the May 9 parade. The European Conservatives and Reformists in the European Parliament expelled him on Wednesday, accusing him of crossing a red line with his recent visit to Russia. He explained that his trip last month was an attempt to reestablish some sort of dialogue with Russia in a time of international tension. In an interview on Sunday, he admitted he expected the ECR to react badly, given that some in the group maintain very pronounced anti-Russian stances. The expulsion is symptomatic of the greater attitude toward Russia and the European Parliament, he said. Sometimes I think that we could touch upon war hysteria. We are not rational in many of our attitudes. Geez, ain't that the truth? Who would expect a European Parliament member to be rational? I certainly don't. But common citizens in the EU reacted differently to his Russia visit. He said that people in the streets came up to him and congratulated him, shook his hand, and tapped him on the shoulder. It was unbelievable. It is clear that there is a divide between Europe's official circles, which may have very anti-Russian stance, and the general public. I happen to agree, friends and neighbors. The regular people in the EU are much, much more moderate, he said, and would really wish to see some dialogue with Russia so that we can start to sort out our differences in a civilized way. Everybody saying that this Ukraine nonsense is not my bag, baby. That's not my bag, baby. Just like Austin Powers. I've stolen that, I suppose. Ahead of his trip, Baltic and Nordic delegations warned Kartheiser that they would push to expel him if he went to Moscow. The Baltic, Polish, and Scandinavian factions in the group are especially outspoken in their anti-Russian stances. Brussels has adopted a tough stance and imposed sweeping sanctions on Russia after the escalation of the Ukraine conflict in 2022. Despite Donald Trump's push to negotiate a peaceful resolution, the EU continues to double down on arming Kyiv. Well, if they're willing to fight, I suppose, you know, if you're dumb enough to give them the arms, but they're just giving it to them on credit. Moscow has accused Brussels of striving to derail the U.S. brokered peace effort and stresses that the recent EU moves to boost defense spending make it the war party of Europe. A guy named Michael Walsh in the comments says, Russophobia, a mental condition where the sufferer believes Russia is both about to collapse and about to take over the world at the same time. And here's another guy, DK. Here's a good one for you. Yes, Russia is collapsing. Both sides know it's just a matter of time. It probably is decades away, but ever since the failure of democracy in Russia, it's inevitable. What we are worried about is exactly what we see all over this board on a daily basis. Many people advocate for Russia to use nuclear weapons. Not me, by the way. The people advocating for the use of nuclear weapons are bitter for a variety of reasons, but all know the future that lays ahead. May as well strike out at the perceived injustice with the only means left available. So yes, we are apprehensive of both. Guy replies, the definition of doublethink. Well, friends and neighbors, we have come to the end of the show. I hope you enjoyed the program this evening. I enjoyed giving it. Hope you enjoyed hearing it as much as I enjoyed putting the information out there for you to hear. You can listen to all of my past podcasts at internationalflavor.com. I encourage you to listen to damradio.com. You can go to damradio.com/schedule to hear anything that you would like. See when the schedule is coming up, what we have for the week. I am the first show of the week, and I kind of like that. And come join me every night at 9 p.m. Chicago time. And if you can't, then certainly listen on any of the means that I've already given you. If you would like to contact me directly by email, that is samuelt@internationalflavor.com. I'd like you to go out and like my Facebook page, join me on Telegram, or many other places. I hope you have a very good rest of the evening and happy upcoming